A new Star Wars journey begins in the place all good journeys begin. At, well, the beginning. This Star Wars Day, I'm excited to introduce the new Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast, where we will piece together the complete story of that galaxy far, far away, in timeline order, from the dawn of the Jedi through the great unknown following the sequel trilogy. This is a podcast for both Star Wars superfans and complete newbies. Listen to the short intro episode now to hear how it works and what to expect over the coming weeks as we set the stage for the new television series The Acolyte, which we will be covering with weekly breakdowns. Subscribe to the Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast wherever you listen to take part in one of the most epic and expansive stories ever told, following all the twists and turns from start to finish. May the Fourth be with you all month and beyond.
A music dance experience.
Don't pervert a handbook passage to me, okay?
You are listening to a Lorehounds Plus Properly Howard production, covering the penultimate episode of season one of Severance. This is the one with the waffle party. Okay, Steve, I'm going to send you an image from my phone. All right, so I'm assuming that you've gotten the image.
Yes.
All right, so I'm reading this book on screenplay writing. You know, there's a lot of structure theory that maybe I've sort of heard of or heard talked about nominally or, you know, around the margins, but never really seen it laid out. Basically, what this author does is he's created this triangle structure, and the three points of the triangle represent classical design, arc plot, which is normal screenplay structure, minimalism or mini plot, and then anti-structure. And so sort of the hallmarks of the classic design are causality, closed ending, linear time, external conflict, single protagonist, consistent reality, and active protagonist. All right, so those are the things that you want in a film or in a screen story classically. My guess is that you lean minimalist. All right. So here's what you would want in a movie if with a minimalist structure. Open ending, internal conflict, multi-protagonists, and passive protagonist. Now, we've not talked about this before, but I'm just curious to hear you sort of answer that accusation. I accuse you, Steve Osborne, of favoring minimalism.
Yeah, in fact, the first screenplay, the only one I've ever written all the way through by myself, kind of follows that, I think. It is open-ended. That's my protagonist is fairly passive.
Okay, so this is interesting to me. Open-ended, according to this particular author I'm reading, it means that it widens the emotional possibility at the end of the film. And so it really sort of leans on the emotionality of the audience rather than telling them what to feel at the end. You kind of leave it open. Mm-hmm. No neat bows tied up at the end. And I thought that was interesting because I know that you're also somewhat a fan of short stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And sort of that is a feature of the short story is the open ending.
Yeah, I think one of the things I like about short stories, not only is that open ending, but you almost feel like you sort of just fall into a world and then fall back out of it.
Internal conflict rather than external conflict. I mean, I don't think that these are hard and fast rules, but I think, you know, I think about the kinds of like serious film that you like. And it's almost like the external conflict's important, but what really draws you in is the internal conflict.
That's I'd say that holds.
And then I would say multi-protagonists. My guess is that you're like, yeah, sure. I mean, I'm fine with one or many or whatever.
Yeah,
not as
that one. That one is probably less.
And so. Then I usually view passive protagonists as less interesting in my view than active protagonists. But the reason why I'm bringing this up is because I think that what we're dealing with Severance is something along the lines of a minimalism plot structure.
Right. Yeah. And it might be what I'm rooting for.
Yeah.
I think we've talked about this as like, how do you end it? And I kind of like go, I kind of hope don't. Like, I mean, it doesn't have to end, right? And I think that's the thing about like our series finales. That's the number one question, right? Like, how does it end? And I think why a lot of people didn't like the end of Sopranos is because that didn't answer that, right?
Yeah, that was open. I think, you know, Severance just ended, or not Severance, but Succession just ended. I think similar critique. I don't know if you, have you seen Ted Lasso yet?
Yes.
Have you seen it all the way through?
Yes.
I think what we're dealing with Ted Lasso is sort of like maybe a hybrid here.
Mm-hmm.
But there were quite a few bows tied at the end of that.
Yeah, it's interesting. The bows were tied, and this is a good deal now with Ted Lasso spoilers. Sorry, Severance listeners. But maybe not so much for Ted. I mean, kind of, but like he's home, but we don't know what that means exactly.
Well, yeah, I think that, for instance, I think with that one, you don't really know what happens with him and his wife, you know. So there is a bit of open endedness there, but in terms of sort of the emotional resonance, it sort of leaves you with a happy feeling, and you get a sense that all these guys are going to be okay,
right?
And I think that's generally a classical design structure. Now let me ask you this. My sense is that most comedy leans on a classical design and maybe needs to lean on that. What would you say to that? I would say that this kind of minimalist structure really works for a show like Severance, which has comedic elements, but I would not consider a, you know, sort of a genre speaking, a comedy.
Right. How do you feel? Well, so again, another one that probably doesn't fall in that category. Yeah, I was gonna say Better Call Saul, but certainly doesn't. I mean, it's not a laugh riot by any stretch.
No. I mean, certainly this is that. That's a very, you know, the Coen brothers used to say there are two kinds of films. There's a silly film and a handsome film. Something like Raising Arizona is very silly. Something like Blood Simple's handsome.
Right.
And I almost feel like something like this is a handsome film. Severance is a handsome film.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a silly film. Although,
well, there's,
I guess you have moments of absurdity, right?
So. Well, that's the thing I think is really fascinating about the two worlds, right? Which we're not entirely sure how different they are, right? Because we know the inside Lumen ethos is very Kier centric, and there are finger traps and dynamite deviled eggs.
Very, very silly, right?
Yeah, there's it's all done. The reason why it's so absurd is because it's done in like this sort of like almost worshipful, religious context. But
did you get the little graphics, like the little computer graphics? Egan flying away.
Yeah, a little double dragon cut scene, but then meanwhile we don't know much about the other. We know that Catholicism exists in outside world. We know that, so that we assume it's part of our regular world. But we do know that
Cobell's mother was a Catholic or something.
Right. So we do know for and some of these people, though, somebody like a Rickon, it matters, which is absurd. right? I mean, because
or the people around him have sort of allowed him to believe that he matters.
That's fair. Yeah, that could be true. But I mean, he exists and he's published. Doesn't look like it's self-published, but it's, you know, so that exists.
Oh no, I would totally say this was a self-published book. That's been my.
You don't think it's on Oprah's list?
No. I do not. Now, hey, I have self-published a couple books myself, so I won't knock self-published books, but Rickon.
Well, you are the Rickon of this podcast.
So. I think that's the nicest thing you've ever said to me. So, all right. So this, I feel like this is a, you know, it's just interesting. I was reading this book this morning. It's a shout out to Robert McKee. This is a sort of a classic book that you would read in a, you know, screenwriting class. And I was just realizing it looks like Severance has a pretty minimalist structure, which really kind of works pretty well for both a pilot episode and a season one, because there's no expectation to wrap everything up.
Right.
So I do think that this has worked so far pretty well. Of course, there's always the danger for people who prefer classical structure, that you might, you know, you'll get to the end of Lost and you'll kind of be disappointed. Alternatively, for someone like you, who was like, wait, the reason I like this is because it was sort of like, it really guarded the mysteries well. And I didn't like that they tied a bow on the end.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. It's interesting, you know, to me.
I like that if it becomes one of these things where it's like so well crafted, and this is where it gets really, you have to write from the ending backwards, uh-huh. right? Where it's so well crafted that when you see it come together, it's like, oh, look at all this was all leading to this moment, right? And
yeah.
And even then, you don't have to necessarily tie a bow on it.
Are you good at tying bows?
I was thinking about that. Probably a couple of days ago, as I was tying my shoes, I'm like, I'm still doing this, huh? Like, it feels like the silliest part of my outfit, no matter what. Even a dress shoe has a bow. I go tie a little bow. And I do it in a way that I was taught when I was a child. And how many things, you know, like, that you were taught that you don't know how to do, that someone else would do for you, that you're like, okay, good. Now I can be, you know, close to 50 and I can tie this little bow on my shoes.
You feel like you've mastered it by now?
Yeah, I think I got it. But I also think like this is, I mean, I understand there's Velcro in this world and there are buckles and there are all these different ways you can have on your shoes, but it just seems like even the bow is like, I don't know.
I thought by now we would all have transitioned to Velcro.
I do have some shoes that I can lace up with an app, which is nice.
With an app?
Yeah, I just have to remember to charge my shoes.
So you've got Back to the Future 2 shoes.
It's the same design. It's they're Nikes. They're not the Back to the Future full, like, I mean, those are very expensive to get the actual, but they're the same. It's the same technology.
Do you have a hoverboard and a jacket that can dry itself?
See, this is what I'm talking about. See, like we got to the bow thing, and then we kind of ended it. We skipped right over to AI.
So the shoes are an actual homage to the film.
Mm. Yeah, they are. I mean, there's a lot of styles in this particular.
Huh.
Yeah, but like, you know, and I can, but it's nice. I can control the those little, like, the buttons on there that, you know, can, they actually, if you don't have your phone, you can lace and unlace with the buttons on the shoe. And you can also control the colors of those buttons.
Do you feel like they get the right tightness? Or does it
Yeah, you can always adjust it. It's got a little wow. scroll thing on there, so you can make it loose. Or
all right, next time I'm over at your house drinking, I'd like to see these things in action.
I know you would.
All right, this is episode 8. What's for dinner? Irving's Audi is shown to be living alone in an apartment where he repeatedly paints identical images of a dark corridor. He also has a dog.
He has a dog.
He's got hot coffee.
Mm-hmm.
And he lives alone, and he just paints.
And he listens to Motorhead's Ace of Spades as his muse.
And the only note that I wrote for this is that I'm kind of jealous of Irvin's Audi's.
Yeah, everything about it is like, boy, that sounds amazing. I love coffee.
I was looking at dogs. I was watching him drink coffee and hit that button for Ace of Spades, and I just thought, this guy is living life. I know this is supposed to be sort of dystopia, but wow, I'm a little jealous.
Yeah, no, he doesn't talk as far as yet, anyway, as far as we know. I mean, kind of just sits there and looks out. He just sits and looks.
I get the sense, I mean, he's out, he's in a park. He's dressed warmly. He's reading a book. He's got a dog. I think that it's meant to tell us, I think the story that you're trying to tell us is this guy's lonely. I gotta tell you.
Yeah.
Gotta tell you. Looks attractive.
Lots of days. This is like, that's like, what would you do if you won the lottery? I'm like, that. I'm looking at it.
Maybe I mix it up. Maybe it wouldn't be Ace of Spades every time.
Well, I think so. Okay, not only that. I mean, the other takeaway that we're supposed to get from our brief look at the Irv is, I mean, just painting the same thing over and over again.
Yeah, yeah.
And, but what's and odd?
You get the sense that maybe this is sort of compulsory,
right? So that's the thing. So here's a glimpse of somebody that, you know, we've only seen. This is the first time we see him out, right? So we've seen Helly, and we've seen Mark, and we've seen just a dash of Dylan.
Yeah.
But so this is the first time we get to see Irv, and he's very methodical. Nothing seems like it. Just seems like, yeah, like you said, there's a loneliness to it. There's a routine to it. And then he goes to painting. And what I find very interesting about the way that they choose to portray this, which, you know, suggests to me it's a clue of some sort, is he's not like, I mean, he's painting in a way that's kind of, like you said, compulsory and maybe a little manic, but nothing leading up to it suggests that's how he is in everything.
Sure.
There's a pragmatism to this, to whatever it is. If it's madness, it doesn't portray itself that way up until the point he starts to, until you see, he's painting that again.
Yeah. So I have some headcanon on this, and I'm not going to save this for spoilers just because I don't think it spoils anything. Here's my headcanon, and I don't know if this is the case, but this is what I've kind of convinced myself of, and clearly I could be wrong. My sense is that Irv has decided to undergo severance because he is sort of an artistic spirit, and he thinks, this will allow me to focus only on my art. So I'm going to sever my brain, and I won't know anything about office politics. That won't have to occupy any of my thoughts. I will be an artist only in my spare time. And I will live the life of an artist, thinking that that's going to be good for his creativity. And then what ends up happening is that the severance procedure so messes his up, so breaks his brain, that the thing that he thought would enhance his creative ability has really almost frozen him.
Mm-hmm.
And so now he's just simply trying to process his trauma, and he doesn't even know what his trauma is. But there's something deep in him that wants to get out that he can only... I mean, I guess that's what trauma is. The trauma is having to relive an experience over and over and over, and you have no control over when you relive it. And so that's my headcanon about him, because I think... he probably was artistic even before he went on under the procedure. And But the only thing that he's producing is the same image over and over and over and over. And it's kind of a commentary on their, you know, the severance procedure actually is horrible for work-life balance.
Right, right. Yeah, and you can go maybe even a step further and say that, okay, if you follow that, he's an artistic soul, and he's painting this, like, it may be one of those things where he paints other things, and he has painted other things, but when he painted this, when this one came up, it triggered something in the subconscious, right? Or it brought him to something that was like, you know how, like, well, Petey would have these split visions after being reintegrated. Maybe just by the virtue of creating something that he didn't really realize where it was coming from, once he made it, it sort of brought him the same way, like Mark made the tree.
Sure.
You know, like something, like he doesn't know where it's coming from, but it came from somewhere, but he's maybe not putting that same level of thought into why, whereas Irving might. So maybe he keeps painting it because he's trying to chase that feeling, or trying to chase
for something authentic, and he knows that there's something down there. But
yeah, and even if it's the same thing, the action of doing it might trigger more.
Yeah, and all he ever gets to is this corridor, which suggests, I mean, just very literally, it's a passage. It's not actually a destination. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting. Let's get back to the painting a little bit later, because I've got more to say about this, but. Helly reaches 100% on her data refinement file, thereby meeting MDR's quota for the quarter. And this results in a celebratory video game graphic from the 80s. I just really laughed hard when Keir turns around and says, "I love you."
Well, what I love about it is he doesn't just say, "I love you." He goes, I love you. Like
he stutters.
Yeah, there's like a moment where it's like either he's like, "Oh, I'm not sure if I'm ready to say this part," or dramatic effect, whatever. It's so bizarre that it's choosing to be like so authentic in that regard.
And the look on her face is like, "Oh, wow. Wasn't really expecting that." It really was. It brought me back to the, I don't know if you remember the final celebratory graphics for Street Fighter 2.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't get there very often because, as you recall, I was a one-trick pony on that video game.
Yeah.
I was all E-Honda, 1,000-point slap, almost all the time. Yeah, no, it had... It just had that feeling like, hey, great job. Now you get to, I guess it's a little odd, you know, after you've gone through this massive process to see these kind of lame graphics.
Right.
I mean, looking back, you know, I spent literally hours trying to beat these video games. And then your reward is like something that you wouldn't choose to watch.
Right.
You know, if you actually were flipping the channels and like saw that on the TV, you wouldn't like stop and say, "Oh, let's see what this is about."
If you knew that, you'd be like, this is what I'm going for.
But, you know, I guess if you're in an environment where no one's telling you that they love you, a little computer graphic Egan saying that and then flying away might be meaningful to you.
Perhaps.
I thought it was a little odd that it's like it's everything's down to the wire. Like there's like a really hard deadline for this.
Right.
And it's like sometime in the morning.
Yeah.
Or it's like a midday deadline, but it has to be like down to the minute. Because after she's done, they've got time for a big party. No one explains why the quota has to be met.
There's a sense of urgency, like, boy, if we don't.
So is this contrived? Is it like, this is sort of part of the experiment? Let's get these people to think that if there's a time limit on this, and if you don't get it done before the time limit, then something horrible is going to happen. Or does this actually matter for Does the quota actually matter?
Right. Yeah, because Cobell is she seems pretty sincere.
Everyone in the office seems to think this is really important. Like they're actually worried that maybe this is not going to work. Maybe this is not going to happen. Now, I can see for the four employees that wanted to have this little plan at the end, in order to make the plan work, they need to have the party, right? They right. need to have their quarterly party experience. So that raises the stakes for them, but then we're back to sort of Cobell's motivations again. Why does everyone act like this is an important quota?
Well, because there's just so much mystery around, like, well, why does any of it matter? You know, and we still don't know why angry numbers or scary numbers matter.
And is the same kind of fervent expectation on, like, in like Bert's tote bags?
Like, right. Are they going to get out?
Are they going to print in time? Right at the deadline here. Everyone in this office, like, geez, I got to touch up this painting in time or else.
I got to get these baby goats are not ready. Oh, no.
I like to think that there's someone whose job it is just to make deviled eggs.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. If they're not just right.
They're pretty good at it. I don't know if you've had a bad deviled egg, but I mean.
Oh, I have. I've had a bad deviled egg.
I mean, there are good deviled eggs, and I've only had them once or twice in my life.
I see. The thing is, I think the majority of deviled eggs are the same in the world. But when you get a transcendent deviled egg, it's never as great as how bad a bad deviled egg is.
It's like the reverse pistachio. It's like you know that 1 in 20 pistachios is going to be rotten.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
going to be rancid. It's going to make you never yeah. want to eat another pistachio.
Yeah, you're like, I just need a pile of fingernails. What did I? What
but then that? You end up, you're like, I got to get this taste out of my mouth. So then you eat another pistachio.
Yeah, I'm going to wash this pistachio down with another pistachio.
Deviled eggs are the opposite. About 1 in 20 is actually worth eating. So why do they still exist? I have no idea. So yeah, I have no idea why the quote is important. And it's weird. It's weird that in this show, it kind of doesn't matter. Everyone's kind of selling the importance of this without us really knowing why. Okay. Cobell schedules Mark for a final wellness session with Miss Casey, during which Mark and Miss Casey fail to remember each other as husband and wife. Cobell orders that Miss Casey be sent back down to the testing floor. Does Cobell want confirmation that they won't remember, or is she trying to make them remember, or what's going on?
That's
with her?
Yeah. This moment feels like she's trying, right? I got that's the vibe I seem to get on this rewatch.
It was almost like, I'm gonna try this one last time. I want,
because even Milchek's like what, like it's our, like we it's been proved, it's functional. We proved it. It works.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the sense that she's like testing it again, or like, well, we're gonna do this again. It's like, it's either she's trying to find a flaw or she's trying to break it.
Well, she already found a flaw because he sculpted the tree, right?
Right.
So I think she's trying to think, okay, I wonder if we do this one more time, maybe I can prove that there's a gap or something.
Right. Yeah, and to the extent that it's like, even Milchek doesn't think she needs to be sent back down to the testing floor, which makes the testing floor sound that much more ominous, right?
Okay, so let's talk about that. Right, so we find out that the testing floor looks exactly like Irv's paintings, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which tells me, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that Irv's been to the testing floor.
Right.
And based on Milchek's sort of demeanor, based on Miss Casey's reluctance, based on Cobell's tone of voice, everything has told me that the testing floor is kind of horrible.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like any time you would, I don't know that a person going to a testing floor always sounds like a bad idea.
So, all right. So, yeah. So this kind of is why I think there's a trauma element to what Irv's doing. And I don't know what kind of trauma we're dealing with. Like, it maybe it's a painful experience to be wiped, or maybe it's well, more like, you know, because we do have the, you know, the break room. Maybe it's, there's a lot of that that goes on down there. I'm not sure.
Well, you're dealing with the chip inside a brain, so it's entirely reasonable to consider that that might do lasting damage to somebody, right?
Mm.
So what we know about Miss Casey, or Gemma, is she's 107 hours old. And most of that time is in the half-hour sessions. So that's there's a lot that's being told here, right? Uh-huh. Is one, how many half hour sessions does she do in a day? Is her whole job half hour sessions? Or does she come in for a half hour? Is she a part timer, right? Or at least consciously part time.
Right.
And the most, because it has to be, right? Because the most she's ever been awake was when she observed Mark's crew. Yeah,
8 hours. Those were her.
So
her
she's never
golden
worked.
Golden moments. Or
that was her golden years. So she's never been awake as long as everybody else. So she just comes in little spurts and fits whenever they go. It's almost as if she gets activated. Right. And that's kind of bonkers. Right. So that sort of speaks to what we've talked about, I think, in previous episodes. Is just like, what is her role? Does she ever leave? Because, I mean, she can't be seen outside by Mark.
Right.
So she's not getting airlifted in, as far as we know. So she's now is
deviled this, eggs.
Now this really feels like Mark is a key experimental cog here, right? Or at least,
right?
You know, there's several of these maybe, but this is a very specific experiment, it seems. And then it starts to beg the question: is like, well, is she just, what else? What is she doing when she's not that? Is she? Are there multiple severance options? Does she exist in Lumen in other ways, on other floors, you know, during the day? Or it's a fascinating idea.
Yeah, can you flip a switch and now she's, you know, she's doing exotic dancing,
right? Because that's
for
the
some
other thing, right?
Floor, you know,
right? We don't, yeah, exactly, because these other folks are wearing all the, you know, the masks being worn. We don't, you know, that's kind of my first thought, was like, is one of them Miss Casey? And so, yeah, it creates, let's say, you know that the testing floor is bad. And what is it? How often has she gone down to the testing floor? You know, is that where she spends a lot of her time? I mean, the fact that she's at center back, what are they doing? What changes?
Well, they're making deviled eggs.
Yeah.
They're practicing their dance routines. They're conducting wellness checks. There's a lot that has to go on, I suppose. These are all questions that the show has not answered, and I don't know if it will answer it. I do like the idea that these wellness checks are complete falsehood.
Right.
We know that Mark on the outside is a total jerk.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's well earned. He's grieving or whatever, but he's certainly, I wouldn't think that he can brighten someone's day with just a smile, or, you know, I just don't believe any of these wellness check facts, so-called facts about any of the people in here. And of course, it just kind of goes to the point that nothing in this office space is what it seems.
I mean, I like to think that it's possible that Audi Mark can get a tent up in under 3 minutes.
that's the thing that is the linchpin for me. That's the smoking gun. It is impossible. Like,
there's no way. There's no way this guy.
No one has ever got a tent up in under 3 minutes.
Not as drunk as Mark is.
Not unless it's a euphemism. All right, next one. Cobell is suspended by the board for withholding knowledge of Hallie's suicide attempt and her extracurricular activities as Mrs. Selvig. Meanwhile, MDR celebrates with the coveted egg bar.
Mm.
Do you have any thoughts on this? There's a lot of this was the office party.
Yeah.
How do you like office parties in general?
Ugh. I mean, it beats working, but I mean, the office party can often
really?
Be
because I would prefer
work. Sometimes, yeah, sometimes work is better than the office party, especially if the office party is like, okay, now that you've done the office party, you have more work to do because you wasted that time. You know, it's like the classic, oh, you don't worry about doing the dishes on Mother's Day, Mom. They'll be there for you tomorrow.
I mean, my feeling with office parties is like I don't even like parties that much. I mean, what?
Yeah.
I realize that the purpose of these things is sort of quote unquote team building. I don't ever really felt like after a party, I feel better about this team.
I'm the guy that would be like, hey, we did a barbecue or we got this thing catered. Come on into the break room. And I go in there and I make a plate and then I go back to my desk. And somebody pointed out, they're like, you're pretty antisocial. And I said, no, I like hanging out with people. I like.
right before you kill them in the shed in the backyard.
Exactly.
All right. Symbolism of eggs. If I was going to say to you that the egg represents a symbol, in what way is an egg symbolic? Any thoughts?
Well, I guess it's like life, right?
Sure.
Fertility.
Fertility, sort of nascent. I mean, you could almost, sometimes people, you would say like, he hasn't come out of a shell, meaning maybe he's not quite social yet. Mm. But I think new life is probably the one that I would most think of. And the reason why I bring this up is not just because of the egg party, but I noticed this episode that the official signage for Lumen in the O, the negative space of the O is like a teardrop.
Mm-hmm.
Similar. Not the same, but similar to an egg shape, right?
Okay.
And then there's a lot with arrows in this show. Like, if you're going to go up, there's a little arrow above the elevator that points up. Similar shape. Teardrop, egg, up arrow, similar shape. And it makes me think, with a show that is sort of demonstrated that it is very intentional with the details, I'm starting to wonder about what these images are suggesting.
That's the thing, right? That's what this show does, is because there's so little information being given, you're forced to try to find clues.
Right. And then of course, all right, so if you saw Lumen, which suggests to me like light, right?
Right.
But then the only image that you see in the text is a drop, either like a water drop or a teardrop or something like that. What would you think that company does?
Yeah, because it looks like a globe at first, right? Like there's a globe surrounding. And then, yeah, I'm going to look at the logo. Yeah, because it's an interesting thing, because all the letters are the same, except that O is purposefully different, right? And it's to the point where it's that would be the logo, and it's the O itself.
Yeah, the O itself is the logo, right? So
yeah, and it's very much droplet, I suppose.
Yeah, it's a droplet. It's a droplet. So like, if I saw that, I thought, is this a light company? Is it a water company?
Water filtration.
Maybe. I, you know, maybe not worth noting at all, but I did pick up on that a bit this episode. All right. So the MDR team prepares for Dylan to remotely awaken them on the outside. Helly kisses Mark before departing. So the plan here, this is their big plan, is to go into overtime mode on the outside, find someone trustworthy, and tell them everything. Is this a good plan?
Well, I immediately get nervous, right? Because we see where Mark's Audi is going to be.
I mean, it's sort of like, it's the kind of thing that, like, I guess this is the first step, but my feeling is that they don't really know what's going to happen next. They're just going to give this a try and kind of see what happens.
Well, they don't have as much awareness of stakes, right? I mean, that's the other side of it, right? It's like they still sort of see their Audi as kind of a fantasy creature. And the outside world as, you know, like, who knows, right? I mean, they have memories of things, so they're aware of language and you know, can speak to things like muscle shows. I don't know why.
Yeah, they've got cultural, you know, touchstones. They can, like, name a state.
Yeah, so they're not gonna go into a world and be like, well, what is that thing? Oh, it's a tree, whatever. But they have no idea what they're about to get into, and they're so, we talk about the childlike nature of the innie.
Yeah.
And it would make sense what they're doing to them, because they're still pretty self-absorbed. They don't have a lot of other things to consider.
Yeah, this plan is almost childlike.
Right.
Who knows? It might help, but it's like they've got no idea what it's going to
be. You ever run away from home when you were like little?
Oh, many times.
Oh, yeah. And it's like, you don't know where you're going to go, what you're going to do.
Get to the bottom of the road and turn around.
Yeah, you get to the bottom of the road and you go, well, I hope that sure taught them a lesson. They're probably missing me so much right now. I'm going
to
go back.
I went so far as to get a stick and tie, mm-hmm.
I made a bindle.
Little kerchief.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to the point where I was looking for a kerchief, yeah. Right? Like, I didn't really, you don't understand hobo culture, and the idea isn't, like, it's not like the kerchief on a stick is the best possible way to transport anything. I live in a house where there are tote bags, backpacks, there are suitcases. I mean, if I was really serious, I would have been fine to take stuff.
You don't know
but
how
instead,
much
I spent
time...
most of my time looking.
You're like, if I could just find a kerchief, I could run away.
Yeah, and it seems like if you find the kerchief now, it's like, now I got to find a load-bearing stick.
I can't tell you how much of my childhood was fantasizing about becoming a hobo.
Oh, yeah. You ever jump on a moving train?
Nope.
It's pretty terrifying.
You have?
Yeah, a train that was just taken off. We were like, hey, let's jump on this train. And then we get on it. And it was that same kind of... And we're old. Like, we're like 18 years old. And it's like, this is a bad idea. And then one of the guys stayed on for a long time. Like, we jump off and you're like, oh, so that was scary. And then the next thing you know, like, he's down. He's probably like, I don't know, 100 yards, 200 yards. And he finally jumps off and the train's picking up a little more speed. We thought that was it. I thought he lived in North Carolina now.
All right. Dylan receives a waffle party as a reward for meeting Quota, in which he dons a Cure Egan head and sits with a replica of Cure's bedroom in the perpetuity wing while ritualistic and seductive dances are being performed in front of him. I mean, we've talked about the waffle party before. Mm. I'd like to point out that in this scene, the masks by the seductive dancers are a jester, a bride, a ram, and an old lady face.
Yeah, and the bride seems a little aghast.
The bride, yes, she seems like she's not too happy with her situation.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the jester seems sinister.
Oh, yeah. The ram's a ram.
Yeah, but that was the one that was a little bit most disturbing to me. I don't know about you.
Well, it sort of does, like, it brings to it a certain, like a pagan ritualistic,
right.
Sacrificial,
yeah, that's
perhaps.
It. That's it. That's
right. Right. And it's interesting because we've seen goats.
That's right. And then the old lady face. And I'm wondering, all right, so there's four masks, there's four dancers, there's four key employees. Would you make any connection there?
Yeah, I was trying to figure that out, if there was. But I mean, it would be very specific to MDR because we know that the other departments have different numbers of people. To me, there has to be a reason, right? Like, those are four very specific choices.
I did notice that the old lady's hair is somewhat similar to Miss Cobell's hair.
Yeah.
Not really sure what to do with that. I think if anyone's a jester, it would be Dylan. Maybe given that that Mark and Helly have sort of like joked about maybe being married on the outside. Because remember this, I think that they were planning on doing this for Mark.
Mm.
I don't think that they were prepared for Dylan, him to actually say.
So you think this isn't just the typical.
No, I think
like
that they,
every time you get the waffle party, you get the same routine.
I think they designed this for Mark.
Mm.
I don't know about the RAM. I don't know about the old lady face. I'm not sure about much else. I'm just calling it out. Just calling it out. It is one of the more memorable scenes of the show so far.
It's so macabre. And then it's juxtaposed with Cobell's just full-on meltdown, right? She's tearing down her altar. And
yeah. So to me, this is interesting. I mean, this is sort of the one thing about this show. I shouldn't say it's the one thing about this show, but it's an outlier because it's almost like this is a reward for something that includes some sort of psychosexual.
Well, and beyond that, it's an award that is given because of a team effort. Yet yeah. One person gets to experience it.
So I'm wondering if there's something about like if you're any only ever experiences office life, that usually would mean that your any doesn't like get to have a sexual identity.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least, you know, the fraternizing is sort of forbidden. So they're all kind of like monks. They're sort of discouraged from lip to lip contact or whatever. So they're the expectation of celibacy, and yet it's sort of like, okay, but if you're really good, we'll show you a little bit of pornography or something.
Right.
It's really messed up. The whole thing's really messed up. I mean, especially considering like someone like Miss Casey's only 107 hours old.
Right. And then you add to the idea that it's like, it's actually is a literal waffle party. I mean, they get a waffle. You know, you're going to do something that wacky. I mean, you can call whatever you want to call it, but
maybe this was all a scheduling snafu, that it was just it was just going to be a waffle, and the dancers yeah. were sent to the wrong room.
Right. It's bonkers. It is definitely bonkers.
All right. Do you have anything else to say about the waffle party?
No, I think the masks and what they represent is just still like, I'm trying to, because I did initially when I saw the hair of the one, I thought like, well, that seems like Cobell like, but I'm like, well, why would they make a mask specific to her?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the one guy comes in and he's a ram. Interesting. Cause like, cause on one hand you go, okay, well maybe there's a story being told from the young bride to this kind of scary looking older woman.
Uh-huh.
But then the other woman's a jester that appears male. I don't know.
Right.
Yeah, it's all goofballs. One thing I think is really important to note too, page 197 slaps.
He's got it memorized.
So good.
He's got that memorized. All right. Mark attends Rickon's book reading party and tells Miss Selvig he plans to quit Lumen. Cobell encourages him to do so. Now, this is after Cobell's been let go. Still unsure about what she was trying to accomplish.
Right.
So, still don't know that. Seemingly, she's had some kind of transformation because she's sort of tearing down the altar to Kier at her house. So maybe she's on a similar path as Irv. You know, Irv takes the handbook and smashes the egg inside the handbook, which looks very much like a Bible, suggesting he's sort of done with the rules and regulations. And she hears that Mark's Audi might be considering quitting, and she's pretty excited about this possibility. And so that leads me to the question, is this how it works? If Mark wants to quit, do they just let him quit? Because he seems pretty important to whatever they're trying to accomplish, he seems integral to it.
Right. And that becomes that to me, that was a question that I took out of that too, is like, how much agency does he have to do that? And they've invested a lot of time and energy and probably finances into whatever it is they're doing with them. And he's the Audi, so you can't control him the same way, and you can't tell him what to do the same way, because now you've got potential press issues and things of that nature. Well,
also,
right?
I mean, Cobell, can you really fire her? She knows a lot about what happens in Lumen.
Exactly,
she knows a lot about what happens in Lumen.
Right. So, that's a big assumption, right? That she's just going to go and then not retaliate or.
So there's a certain amount of confidence, like we know we got something over her, or we know that there's going to be a pun intended severance agreement or something like this.
Or they have some sort of still have some sort of control over her, which would suggest that maybe everybody's chipped in a way they don't realize.
Right. Yeah.
Because there's so many questions about, like, when are they being watched and why are they not being watched all the time? How much can Milchick see? How much does he know? How is anybody able to get away with anything ever?
Yeah. Speaking of getting away with something, Dylan leaves midway to access the security office and activates the overtime contingency to awaken Mark, Irv, and Helly's innies in the outside world. Okay. Now, you were the person that kind of alerted me to this in our previous conversation. But I want to call these out again. The different modes that an employee can be in when they're severed is Beehive, Branch Transfer, Clean Slate, Elephant, Freeze Frame, Glasgow, Goldfish, Lullaby, Open House, and Overtime. Seemingly, we know what overtime is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Overtime means it's your work consciousness in the outside world, right? It's mm-hmm. something very specific. It's not like a reintegration or anything like that. It's your work self. It's the innie waking up as an outie. And you suggested before that you thought maybe Irv was in like a goldfish state.
Right.
Meaning like he's just going in around a circle, or what did you
yeah. So that? Basically just the same, like he's got like, oh, get up, do this. All right, let's go do that again. And then let's just go do that again. And let's just go do that. Like just sort of.
So he's just in a cycle, a never ending mm-hmm. cycle. All right.
Right.
And I think that we suggested that, I don't know, did we say what we thought Beehive might be?
I don't know, but that's a question, right? Like, so you could, there's a few ways to think of a beehive. One of it's sort of being just loud and chaotic. The other side of that is like, that's like worker bees doing worker bee stuff, right?
Yeah, you're just a drone or something.
Right. So that would, you could almost, like, you could maybe almost make the argument to some degree, maybe Miss Casey was beehived for a while.
Sure. Okay. Branch transfer.
That to me would suggest that you go to another department and you don't remember you were in a different department.
Right, right, right. So you keep your cultural memory and maybe you've lost your personal memories of the previous department or something.
Mm-hmm.
Because you could think like, all right, see you later, Bert. And, you know, everyone assumes that Bert is happily retired, but in reality, Bert could just be making deviled eggs or whatever.
Right.
Clean slate. You suggested before that that's just wipes everything, all memory, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Elephants suggest that you always remember, right?
Never forget. Right. Yeah, that's what we said. Yeah, I think we said with the clean slate too. Like, and thinking about it now, like here, these guys are about to go out. You know, assume that this overtime contingency works.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, how do you get them back? Well, maybe you can clean slate them, and they just come back to work, and like it's day one.
Another option for Irv would be freeze frame.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on what that is, I mean, I guess you could suggest that. That person is constantly living in the same moment over and over and over again, right? So,
right.
I did a little bit of research on Glasgow. It's possible that we overlapped research. Did you have a sense of what Glasgow is?
No.
Okay, I did research on Glasgow. So there's something called the Glasgow Coma Score, and so there are different levels of comas that you can be in. You know. Sort of ranging from almost conscious to really, really not conscious.
Mm.
And so my thought was that Glasgow means coma.
Okay.
That would be my guess on that. Lullaby is, I think, just puts you to sleep. We know what overtime is. Open house. Any ideas?
That makes me wonder if people can get into your brain.
Oh, jeez. I mean, aren't they already in the brain?
Well, I mean, like, you're free to now see things through them like you access them.
Huh.
Or more people can, you know. Because when I think of an open house, what you see, like, whether it's a, you know, if it's an actual, like, real estate type situation, right? You had to go in and get to see everything kind of staged.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. So, all right. Let's jump into spoilers here. I think that we got an answer in this question. I think I might have brought up this question in a previous episode was why is the way that they're surveilling Mark so low tech?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas they have pretty advanced neurotechnology.
That's one of the things that keeps getting me about all the technology that the Lumen employees interact with versus like the medical staff.
Right, right, right.
Get to work with.
Well, I think part of it gets answered this episode. We know that Cobell's moonlighting as Miss Selvig is totally off the books.
Right.
So she doesn't really have access to all of Lumen's resources.
So almost like everybody, once you get into that section, you are limited,
right?
With what technology you can interact with.
Sure, sure, sure. Because if open house is what you say it is, you know, why aren't people just looking through Mark's eyes?
Right.
Unless
the Severance Project is both worlds.
Right. Right. Yeah. The other thing for spoilers that I noted was, do you know who Michael Silbury is? He's an actor.
No, I don't think so.
You'd probably recognize him. Anyway, he was the voice of the Kier graphic.
Okay.
And on the IMDb page, he's supposed to be the present CEO. That actor is playing the present CEO. Of Lumen.
Oh, okay.
And he's an Egan descendant.
Mm.
So I mean, who knows whether he'll be in season two or not, but I thought that was an interesting connection.
It's just, it's as far as like a penultimate episode goes, it's pretty good, right? I mean, it's great Great cliffhanger.
Oh, it's this is like this perfect cliffhanger.
I kind of figured that the final episode would be him doing this, Dylan doing this, and then we get like a brief glimpse into the Audi world, and then it's over. But it's like, I remember first time I saw this, I'm like, wait, we're gonna get a whole episode post you know, post overtime contingency.
Yeah.
No, it's wild.
I did note that I was looking at who directed the episodes.
Mm-hmm.
My sense is that the writing credits for each episode are kind of, they don't tell the whole story, because with writers' rooms, some people, sometimes they just sort of divvy out credit, even though kind of everyone's thumbprints is on every screenplay. But with directing, usually the listed director is the person who actually directed the show. And it looks like what Stiller did was Stiller did the first three episodes and the last three episodes. And then there was another director for the middle three.
Okay.
Did you sense that there was sort of a lag or a tonal shift in the middle of the season?
I don't think so.
I didn't feel like that either. I felt like it was pretty, it kind of built.
Yeah, yeah. No, everything felt like it was on like a logical trajectory, at least a tone and everything just kept moving towards it. I didn't feel any shift. And I remember I made a note too, pencil note, looking at the director, when the director changed, I was like, I wouldn't have known. You know, I'm sure there's some stamps that they put on their own, but I mean, they did a really good job of keeping it. Because sometimes that you do that with series, right? Like all of a sudden one episode clearly feels different than another, even if it's still moving the story along.
I mean, even with Barry, you know, I don't know if the first season was this way, but basically the last few seasons were Bill Hader, you know, he basically directed all of them.
Yeah.
But even with this last season of Barry, I did feel like there were a couple laggy episodes.
Yeah, no, I agree.
This first season was, it was like every episode was better than the last.
Yeah, it was surgical.
All right, well, I think we've prepped well enough for the season finale.
Yes, sir.
Which I'm looking forward to.
Is it DeFranco to Bean?